This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Solar Storm. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, coming to you this April 12th, 2015. Thank you so much for joining me here at RenegadeBroadcasting.com. I urge you to please check out all of the great shows here on the network. We have a very good lineup. So we have something every night of the week for you from a variety of different perspectives. Tonight, I am very pleased to have with me the illustrious John Lamb Lash. John is a comparative mythologist. He is author of Not in His Image, a revealer of Sophianic mysteries, a Gnostic warrior, and the founder of the Calico War Party, and much more. You can find his work on GaiaSpora.org and MetaHistory.org. And tonight we're going to be talking about some of the Gnostic materials and John's history, looking into the very occulted subject. We will be discussing the Archontic Infection, White Genocide, Jewish Influence, and so much more. John, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Well, I am very glad to have you here, and this is a show that people have been requesting for quite some time. We were in touch last year, towards the end of the year, looking to possibly make a show happen, but things didn't work out, and gratefully, now here we are, and I think it is the perfect time. You haven't been doing a whole lot of shows out there. You've talked to Henrik a few times with some great interviews that people should check out, and you do your own newsflash over at GaiaSpora.org. But it's always just a real treat to be able to get you on the air talking about the problems facing the world, and we're definitely going to get to that, and also dealing with the solutions that you have in mind. But before we get there, John, I wanted to get you more, I want the audience to be more familiar with who exactly you are if they haven't been aware of you for a number of years and listening to your different podcasts and interviews. So could you tell us a little bit about how you got into Gnosticism, a little bit about Not in His Image, and the response that that's received around the world, and then also what exactly Gnosticism is?
Well, sure. I think it would be helpful if I can present a little background on myself, not only to familiarize readers with where I'm coming from, but to kind of set the course for our our conversation this evening. Let me just say that I consider myself to be a natural-born mystic. That is to say, from an early childhood, I had what might be called mystical or supernatural experiences. But having said that, I would add that I think pretty much everyone does. I think that children, before they are corrupted and indoctrinated, are in touch with the supernatural dimension of life, and that they are in touch with nature, which is itself an expression of the supernatural. The problem is that we don't stick with these experiences. They get denied, they get ridiculed, and we lose track. I guess you could say I stand as an example of someone who always stuck with those initial mystical experiences, lucid dreams, encounters with the beauty and power of nature. And it was that persistence that led me to Gnosticism.
Briefly, what do you think the main culprits are that have gotten us away from these experiences? Because I tend to agree with you that most people could be open to them, though I think some people have natural proclivities in this area for sure. But I think personally that it would be the television, the school system, and the religious indoctrination, just off the top of my head, that is really standing in the way of someone who, a child in the supernatural as he's growing up.
Well, indeed. And I agree with you, Kyle, that just like not all of us have inclinations to music or to mathematics or to certain skills, maybe some of us are more inclined or disposed to these mystical experiences. I certainly was. And a great responsibility comes with that disposition. Let me just say this. We could list 20 influences upon the human animal in childhood that deviate us from our own nature and from the endowment of our intelligence. But I would say that we can summarize all of those influences, be it television, the educational system, religion, politics. We can summarize them all as having one thing in common. They alienate the human creature, the human animal, from its connection to nature and to the natural world and to the planet. What I have in me, and many people listening now, I think will resonate to this as well, is an undefeatable and deathless love of this planet. I love the natural world. I am in awe of the beauty, majesty, and power of this planet, and of the magnificent design of nature. The very mystery of creation is right in front of us all the time, but we lose the sense of the mysterious. I have never lost the sense of the mysterious.
If there was going to be a universal religion, I would have to think it would be the adoration of the planet upon which we live, which sustains us, which offers us so much beauty. And also its relationship with the sun and our relationship with the sun and all its life-giving, amazing properties and the connection we can have to it as well. And yet that is not what we have on the in the world today. The main religions of the world today are so far divorced from anything that is healthy and natural, like I just mentioned. And I'm sure you ran into this just the way I did growing up, that you just did not resonate with what that good book was saying. Now, where did you turn when you were looking for answers? There, especially then, without the internet, there weren't really too many well-trodden paths for a real truth seeker and somebody in search of meaning for these mystical experiences.
Well, I guess I could say the key factor in my personal spiritual odyssey, if you will, was a deep passion to know how to connect with the earth. I knew that I was connected with the earth. I loved it, and I always have loved it. I grew up in a natural paradise in Maine, the coastal town of Friendship, Maine, which was absolutely an exquisite natural paradise for a boy to grow up in, and still is. But before I had the knowledge that the earth is divine, that she is truly our mother, that she is a goddess, all of which are Gnostic teachings, before I had that knowledge, I had the sensation and the intuition that it was so, you see? And I think it was holding on to that love and that intuition that eventually led me to the source of knowledge about the divinity and intelligence of the earth. And that is how I would define Gnosis.
John, on a very scientific, materialist type of level,
sure,
you could actually study the electromagnetic connection and exchange of a human being and the earth.
That's right.
It's actually pretty well studied. And it seems that if you go out and you ground yourself off and go walking around in the dirt with your bare feet, this actually has a good number of health benefits. And this is all just kind of pointing in the direction of us possibly also having a very important other connection to the earth. As if the electromagnetic connection wasn't enough, we have a very, very serious, some would call it religious or mystical or trans-dimensional spiritual connection with this earth. And it's sad that most people are so disconnected that they can't realize it. Perhaps it's the women walking around in the high heels, so disconnected from the earth in a very literal sense, or whatever else the case may be. We're taken out of this natural environment, especially at an early age, and put in schools, indoctrination centers, under fluorescent lights, and taken away from the natural cycles and rhythms of this world. And it really is a travesty. Now, what specifically do you mean in terms of your connection to it? Were you gaining information from the earth? Were you how did this unfold for you?
Well, my connection with the earth, as I speak of it today, going on 70, and having been on this quest since I was 4 years old, I was awakened to the quest by a lucid dream at the age of 4. So as I speak today, I don't just speak for myself. I speak for every human animal. I prefer to call us animals. The sense, you can say that it is a belief to say that the earth is divine and that the human animal is embedded in the divine living presence of the earth. You can say that's a belief, just like any other belief. But Gnosticism is the way of knowing how that is so, knowing how that is actually so, and entering interactively into deeper and deeper connection with the planet. That's what it is. And it is a unique system of knowledge. Gnosis means knowledge. It is not a belief system. It's a testable, and verifiable path of knowledge. That is Gnosis. And I came to that Gnosis in my mid-20s when I discovered the Nag Hammadi documents, which were found in Egypt in 1945, coincidentally, probably, perhaps, in the week that I was born, the first week of December 1945. Now, these Nag Hammadi documents were written in Coptic. They're very badly written. They're very fragmentary, and they have been translated into English, I think, in 1976, in a manner which hardly goes beyond gibberish. So there is a great challenge in finding what is the knowledge in the Gnostic teachings that remain to us. And I have dedicated a great part of the last 20, 30 years of my life to doing that. So that's mainly what I'm known for, as a revivalist of the Gnostic view of life and what may be called the Sophianic vision of life.
So is it kind of like having missing puzzle pieces and having to try to reconstruct what the painting was actually representing, having to extrapolate from the sparse materials and try to really fill in the gaps? Is that what you've been doing with the Nag Hammadi texts? And could you talk about
exactly?
Can you talk about what is known, and then also what you've been able to add. This is a huge discussion, but I just kind of want to get through this so we can get to the next steps of our conversation. I think a lot of people don't really understand what Gnosticism means, and I think that there's been a lot of disinformation about what the Nag Hammadi texts reveal.
Well, most certainly. In fact, I think I could steer your listeners to the core of the subject in this way. Yes, first of all, you are absolutely right. Piecing together the Gnostic message required a tremendous exercise in forensics and in detective work. I have, however, if you go to metahistory.org and if you look at my book, Not in His Image, which came out in November 2006, I can assure you that I am not speculating wildly, that I do work rigorously upon the existing materials, and I do extrapolate some of them, but I do use the foundation in the existing materials, and it's a very difficult job. But to orient people to Gnosticism, I would say that there are two perspectives to consider. First, we can go into what the knowledge of Gnosticism tells us about the earth as a living being, a divine being, about the origin of humanity and the earth, the origin of extraterrestrial parasites, and many other things. So let's call that the content, the message, and the teaching of Gnosticism. We're going to get into that a little bit this evening by way of orientation. But before I do that, I want to say something that is equally important, and that is, I want to say something about Gnosticism, not about the message of it, but about the phenomenon itself. What every person listening to this interview needs to know at the get-go is that the subject of Gnosticism is the most maligned, misrepresented, and suppressed subject in the world. And that is a fact. That is not my interpretation. That is an historical fact. The Gnostic teachings from the Levant, particularly, that is to say Palestine, Syria, the Middle East, and from Alexandria in Egypt, have been the single most repressed, demonized, and attacked teachings of any culture or tradition in the entire world. And I want people to just take a moment to register this fact. You know, you can go and study Taoism, you know, with the internet today, you can go and study anything you want. You can go and study Taoism, Hindu religion, you can go and study the beliefs and magical practices of the Aztecs and the Maya, and on and on and on. And you'll find a vast amount of knowledge about these various systems. But the knowledge system of Gnosis has been the target of the greatest attacks that are known. The writings of the Gnostics, which ran by ancient estimates into the millions of scrolls, were burned and destroyed. The Gnostic teachers, such as Hypatia, were murdered, and many of them were driven into exile. And the entire message of Gnosticism was subject to a disinformation program unlike anything else that you can see in human history. So if you're interested in Gnosticism and you're getting your attention right now, the first thing you want to ask yourself is, what is there about this message that it needs to be kept from access by humanity?
Well, I'll give my answer briefly, and maybe you could touch upon this and tell us a little bit more about the whole Gnostic message. But I think it's because we're living in the world of the demiurge. We're living under almost complete control of this figure known as Yahweh, but who the Gnostics, at least from my understanding, label as the demiurge, a somewhat insane deity that has been cut off from the true source, doesn't really know its own origin, so has assumed that it is the god of all creation, when in fact it's just ruling over something it didn't even create. And it is a parasitic entity feasting upon humans as prey. And of course, we get that word prey as well, what the followers of the Demiurge do to satisfy this sick, psychopathic god. Perhaps I'm a little bit incorrect in my interpretation, so please feel free to correct any errors and let us know maybe a little bit why it is really that this teaching is so suppressed.
Well, there's nothing to correct there, Kyle. Your paraphrase is more or less accurate. Perhaps the first thing that one encounters, certainly, in the staggering and stunning message of Gnosticism. And if you're not staggered and stunned, by the way, you're not getting it, because it is truly awesome. The first thing you encounter is the historical fact. Again, this is not an interpretation of mine. That in the early Christian centuries, around 150 AD, there occurred evidence of a controversy or debate between the Christian ideologues who were propounding Judeo-Christian religion and certain people whom they call Gnostics, meaning those who know, those who are experts, those who are in the know. And in this controversy, which didn't last very long, because the Christians, as they rose to power, and as Christianity became the state religion under Constantine, decided to violently wipe out the other side of the argument. But in the evidence that we have of this debate, the Gnostics came forth from their long-standing tradition in the so-called mystery schools, which they founded, the pagan pre-Christian mystery schools. They stepped forth and they stood before the first proponents of Christianity and they said, hey, look, we'd like to point something out to you just for the purpose of argument. We understand that you are propounding an ideology of salvation, that you consider there was a male creator God who is not on the earth, an off-planet God, who created the entire universe. You consider that this God selected a chosen people whom we know as the Jews to represent him among the non-Jewish nations, that he sent or is going to send a Messiah, and that at the end of time he is going to exercise an act of judgment upon the entire human race, and he's going to select those who obey him and destroy those who don't. We understand that this is your Judeo-Christian narrative. And we'd like to tell you that your narrative is not only wrong, but it is dangerously deluded. And we are Gnostics, that is to say, we are shamans and seers who base our system of knowledge, not belief, upon centuries of careful investigation and study by our Gnostic teams or cells. And we can tell you that according to our knowledge, this deity that you consider the supreme deity, maybe called the Demiurge or Yahweh, we have already recognized this deity, who it is. Our tradition of Gnostical seers identified this deity thousands of years ago. And we warn you that this deity is not a true god, but it is, in fact, an extraterrestrial alien god pretending to be the creator, and that you are following a god who is a pretender and who is actually acting against humanity. And now, that was the Gnostic message to the early Christians.
When you say an extraterrestrial god, mm-hmm. Do you mean one that maybe actually visited those earlier people? I mean, people had such a religious devotion to this God and his angels, that it leads me to think, hey, maybe this whole ancient aliens idea could have some validity. Perhaps these people in the ancient world were awed by these people who came from the heavens and possessed magical powers.
That's not correct.
Okay.
That's not correct. Not according to the Gnostic view. The Sitchin hypothesis and the ancient astronaut hypothesis of von Daniken, of course, have been enormously popular. Speaking strictly from a Gnostic point of view, These views are wrong. They are distorted. They represent a version of what the Gnostics knew, but in a rather distorted mirror. As if you were to see your own face in a funny house mirror, you're not going to see what you really look like, are you?
Or copies of a copy, you know.
Where they're copies of copies, they're distortions.
Yeah.
You see, the fact is that before this ideology of Judeo-Christian supremacy, which I call salvationism, before this whole narrative was imposed upon the human race, the great majority of people living on this planet were in awe and lived in awe continually of the planetary goddess herself. That was the original awe. They were never in awe of gods who came down from the heavens in spaceships. That is not correct. That scenario is a false scenario. It's a fabulation and a very harmful one.
Now, this story of the Earth goddess and her kind of fall into this material realm, living as
right.
the Earth. Is this mentioned in the Nag Hammadi text, or is this something you kind of had to piece together a bit?
Okay, let me make it clear to newcomers that the sources of my research you can find on metahistory.org in a number of places. Just go to the search engine and say, look for Gnostic sources, and you'll see a complete explanation. Basically, there are two sources of Gnostic knowledge, the Gnostic message, and the Sophianic narrative, which I'll define in a moment. The main source is the Nag Hammadi codices, or books, discovered in Egypt in 1945, and they're written in Coptic, said to be based on Greek originals. The second source is Greek and Coptic documents that are not in the Nag Hammadi collection. And among that second source are contained prominently and significantly what are called the polemics of the church fathers. These are a vast number of documents that you can find in theological libraries that contain arguments of the early church fathers, such as Irenaeus and others, against the Gnostics. So what these documents, which are written in Greek and Latin, represent is kind of a case for the prosecution of the Gnostics. So much of the original Gnostic material was destroyed that we have to go to the opposition and look at the dossier of the prosecution to hear about some of the things that Gnostics said.
And of course, it's the same way with Celts and their history being written by Roman historians.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. So those are the sources. Now, let me go from there to say that I have adhered very closely to those sources. In fact, I think that I've adhered to those sources more comprehensively and soberly than any other Gnostic scholar. So I'm making very, very little up here. I have extrapolated somewhat from those sources, but very, very cautiously. So now let me give you the essence of what the Gnostics taught. Basically, the Gnostic message for humanity has three parts, A, B, and C, if you will. The first part is a narrative. It contains a narrative or a myth, if you will, not in the derogative sense, you know, a myth as a description of events that actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
It contains a story of the planet Earth. It contains an astronomical and cosmological narrative that is more complete and comprehensive and detailed than any such narrative produced by the human mind. This is a fact. In fact, the Gnostics left us, or I should say, in their remains, we find evidence of a comprehensive astronomical myth of the origin of the human species and the Earth itself. And this is called the Sophianic myth, or the fallen goddess scenario. If you Google fallen goddess scenario, you will find that every single entry that comes up refers to me. Now, you might be misled by that in thinking that I invented the fallen goddess scenario, but I did not. I simply restored it. But my restoration is so unique that I am the only source on the internet for this scenario.
So, John, there are a number of mythologies out there that I'm aware of that do teach that the Earth was actually a living giant. For example, the Norse mythology has Ymir, who was slain to create this world. In Japan, they have Pangu.
Right.
And of course, it makes you think of Pan, the goat god, the all god, Pan meaning all, as in panorama.
Right. Right.
And also, it's right there in the name, Japan. So they have these male deities who were killed or died to form the Earth. But you're saying that perhaps the original teaching, the correct one, is that it was actually a goddess and that she's not completely dead. She didn't die.
Let's make some important distinctions here, and these are what I call excruciating Gnostic nuances. Okay, when you get into Gnosticism, it is a challenge. You cannot be spoon-fed Gnosticism. It challenges your intelligence and your discernment to the highest degree, I warn you. And it is not for the weak-minded. So let me make a couple of excruciating Gnostic nuances that may clarify the path ahead here. I think we're doing pretty well in the first half hour because it's an awesome subject, right?
Oh, yeah.
First of all, I'm a comparative mythologist. I have compared all the myths of all cultures in the world. I have looked at over 200 specific creation myths in great detail. I can assure you that the Gnostic creation myth of the fallen goddess, Sophia, is the single, complete, coherent, and comprehensive story that we have of the origin of the Earth and humanity. Other myths present fragments of that story. They present, say, anecdotal episodes, but not the entire plot. Gnosticism gives us the entire plot of the planet. Secondly, I would point out and caution you that when you go to investigate these mythological narratives, which are not merely superstitious tales made up by ignorant people, but are mythopoetic plots describing enormous events that actually happened, when you investigate them, there's a tendency for people to confound myths about the creation of humanity and myths about the creation of the Earth itself. So, for instance, you cite the Norse myth of Ymir. That is not a myth about the creation of the Earth, although it has been mistaken for such. It is actually a Norse myth closely parallel to the Gnostic narrative about the creation of the human species.
Oh, okay.
Of the anthropos, okay? So this distinction has to be made on a case-by-case basis. When you go into any creation myth, whether it be from Polynesia, of the Aztecs, of the ancient Greeks, the ancient Germanic tribes, you have to ask yourself, you have to bring Gnostic discernment. You have to ask yourself, am I seeing material that represents a story of the creation of humanity or a story of the creation of the Earth? But when you go to the Gnostic material as I have restored it, you get the entire overarching plot in which both aspects are clear.
Okay. Well, John, I wanted to compare another myth here and ask you if Lucifer, the fallen god, is actually representative in some way of the fallen goddess that we're speaking of.
The true identity of Lucifer is Sophia.
Lucy.
Lucy. Yeah, Lucy in the sky with diamonds, baby. You can believe it. And I have to say I'm so grateful for you to bring up this point, Kyle, because one of my self-assigned tasks as a Gnostic, modern day or reborn Gnostic, if you will, is to correct error. And the Gnostics themselves were very rigorous on that. They corrected their own errors, and they tried to come out, as I just explained, and correct the error in the Judeo-Christian ideology of salvation, salvationism. And for that, they were murdered and destroyed, because the forces behind that salvationist ideology cannot allow coexistence of anything that would expose the true identity of their god as a grotesque alien working against humanity. And so everyone who could expose them and correct that narrative had to be destroyed. And it's a fracking miracle that the amount of Gnostic material that survives today still exists. It's only a fragment. But that fragment is powerful enough to blow Judaism, Christianity, and Islam right off the planet. And they came from off the planet in the first place. So I think it would be a good idea to consider doing that.
Now, John, Lucifer is a figure that has been perhaps maligned for thousands of years now, and very misunderstood. But it's easy to see how people who are looking for the truth, who are looking on YouTube, they see all of this evidence about the Masons worshiping Lucifer, the Luciferian Jews, the Lucifer worship in the church, you know, with the halos or whatever the case may be. I saw this for years and years and years when I was looking for the truth, and I knew that something was a little bit bogus about what I was being fed. Can you talk about how a lot of people can't seem to get past this Judeo-Christian programming when they're searching for the truth?
Well, the Judeo-Christian programming, and add to it, of course, the Islamic programming, which kicked in some centuries later, has been so deeply ingrained in us by intimidation. It all works through intimidation. Look at how intimidating the Muslims are. Well, Christianity rose to power by intimidation, by the threat of eternal hellfire and judgment, didn't it? Judaism was and is a message of massive intimidation and the threat of genocide and the threat that the chosen people will destroy anyone who is not on their side. All this intimidation has deeply perverted and distorted human intelligence. Now, on the subject of Lucifer, I have to be brutal, and this is just my opinion. You can take it or leave it. I've investigated what people say about Lucifer, the Luciferian religion of the Masons, the Luciferian Jews, all of these claims. I've investigated it extensively since I wrote Not in His Image. I consider that people who are purporting to expose Luciferian religion are dupes, and they are completely deluded. And even the people who purport to belong to Luciferian religion and who consider themselves to be Lucifer worshippers are deluded fools. The whole subject of Lucifer belongs to what I would call, Kyle, the fog of war. You know, the fog of war is a well-known term, right?
Yes.
And the fog of war is a terrible thing, isn't it? If you are out as a foot soldier out on the battleground and you're in the fog of war, like many young kids of my age were in the Vietnam War, you don't know what the fuck is going on. You don't know who is shooting who. You don't know who the enemy is. You could be killing gooks. You could be killing your best friend, right? The fog of war is very real. Well, I'm here to tell you that there is a fog of war around the war for the human mind. There is a war on this planet raging for the intelligence of the human mind, and the divine birthright of humanity is under threat. And many people are lost and confused in the fog of war. I can tell you, as a comparative mythologist, who some people consider to be of the level of Joseph Campbell and Mershe Eliade, even though I myself don't make that claim. It's been said of me. I assure you that the true Lucifer is none other than the divine goddess Sophia. Why is she Lucifer? Because Lucifer means the light bearer. Why is she the light bearer? Well, this is a great secret from the pagan and Gnostic mysteries, that she is the origin of what I call the organic light. That is to say that the Gnostics knew something that I myself have verified by shamanic researches in my own lifetime. And I have not done this alone. I have done it with other confirming witnesses. The Gnostics knew that when the divine Sophia, who was a light being of high living luminosity, called an aeon, came from the galactic core And when she turned into the earth, as explained in the story, part of her divine luminosity did not completely materialize into the mountains, the rivers, the clouds, the skies, and the body of the earth. Part of it remained in its original pleromic purity. That is to say, the purity of the light at the galactic core. The purity of the light at the core of our galaxy is staring you in the face right now. It is present in this planet. I call it the organic light. And therefore, if you read the story, if you give yourself a chance to look at the Gnostic narrative of Sophia, you will see that it is self-evident that only she is the true Lucifer, and that it is not a satanic and perverted influence, but it is in fact our divine origin.
John, you mentioned the planet having real luminosity. Now,
right.
This is seen in the diagrams of people who promote the idea of the hollow earth, that there's actually a sun in the center of the earth, a star, mm-hmm. rather. A secret sun, perhaps even the black sun could be what's referenced. Now, our current scientific understanding, what I got in textbooks when they show me the earth and they give a cross section, even though they've been able to only get down a few miles into the earth's crust, our scientists are so, so knowledgeable that they tell us what it's like at the very core. How amazing, what perceptive abilities that they're able to say definitively how each layer of the earth is. Could you touch upon this this idea that perhaps there is a star within the earth, that the earth might be hollow, that it's open at the poles, and also just what science is saying about it, and clear up some of these misconceptions perhaps?
Okay, I'm not going to address the hollow earth theory as such or try to refute it. I will take a different angle. I will put the matter in the form of a question. If it is true, as I say, that the Gnostics, operating as teams of trained shamans and seers over many centuries, determined that we can witness the origin of the earth directly as a white, soft white luminosity pouring from the planet, then wouldn't it be reasonable to consider how to have that experience rather than to speculate about what is inside the earth? They had that experience of the organic light. That is the experience of attaining the Holy Grail. It means to stand before the living, white, milk-white, soft luminosity that is emanating from this planet due to the fact that the material body of the planet is simply the garment or clothing of a divine being who came from the galactic center. The Gnostics called the galactic center the Pleroma, and they explained that the Pleroma is a molten core of this white stellar luminosity. So they then determined how to prove that was the case by directly accessing and witnessing that luminosity.
Is the aurora borealis perhaps part of this luminosity of the planet?
Aurora borealis and other phenomenon like sprites in the atmosphere are part of what you would call, what I call the BEMA, the B-E-M-A, which is the bioelectrical magnetic aura of the planet. Now, the organic light, which has been called by other names, the Sophianic light, the Sophianic radiance, the alchemists called it by many names. It was called the philosopher's stone, the white stone of the philosophers. It was called the Sophic hydrolith. It has many coded names. The organic light is the pure, non-materialized stellar luminosity of the divine being called Sophia. And it is still present and coexists in the earth with the part of her that turned into the material body of the earth. This is the great revelation of the Gnostic teachings. So we've covered two parts now. I think we're doing great because we're only 45 minutes here, and we said we would cover the background in the first hour, right?
Yes.
Let me summarize. There are three parts to the Gnostic message for humanity. The first part is the Sophianic narrative, the fallen goddess scenario, explaining how the earth came to be. Now, let me say that, of course, we can't go into this scenario in depth, but you will find it outlined on metahistory.org, and you will find it treated extensively in my talks, especially the talk with Lisa Harrison.
Oh, great, great show. If people want a good overview of the subject, that's
right.
One
Let
to
me
go
just
to.
Point out that one of the astounding points of this narrative, which is the birthright of humanity, it's the story of our origin and of the origin of our planetary mother. One of the astounding points of it that you do not find clearly in any other cosmology or creation myth is this. It states clearly that the divine presence, the living divine presence, which I call Gaia Sophia, which is currently existing in the earth, pre-existed the earth. In other words, those of you who today who might be attracted to a pagan viewpoint, looking at the earth as divine, as a living being, as the mother goddess, as the earth goddess, those of you who are inclined to that view, I encourage you to consider the amazing statement of Gnosis, which is, yes, that is true. Gaia is a living goddess, but she even existed before she was Gaia. And that is what the story tells. So we have a magnificent story, A. B is the method of the Gnostics, or the method of the mysteries. This is called the divine mathesis, which means instruction by the light. The Gnostics had a method, and they all had the same method, and I have used and tested this method myself today. And as I say, I have not done it alone. I have done it in the company of others, and there is a growing number of people who will affirm to you what I am saying now.
Is this method similar to, say, some of the methods of the Zen Buddhists, especially before they became perverted, or even philosophy itself? Because the name philosophy derives from philo, Sophia.
Yeah.
Love of Sophia.
Yeah. Right. No, it is a specific method, which is called the Telestic method.
Okay.
Telestic. This word derives from the Greek word telestes, which is what the Gnostics actually call themselves. You know, Kyle, I pointed out in the first half hour that Gnosticism was viciously attacked. The Gnostics came out of the mystery schools to warn the early Christians that they were on a very dangerous road of delusion and self-destruction by accepting Yahweh as the true God when he was only an imposter. He was an archontic God, a pretender. And they warned against that because they had direct knowledge of the story of Sophia, and they called they called themselves Telestes, meaning we who are aimed, we who are guided. So they were guided by her story to the truth, and they had a method for staying on the path of truth. And what is that method? It is the method of what I call Telestic shamanism. Now, I hope to put the term Telestic shamanism into public discussion. As you know, I am the person who put the term archons on the map.
Oh, yeah. I want to cover the archons.
We're coming to that.
Briefly, that's, yes.
Right. That's the third point. But I'm still on the second point right now.
Okay.
So let me just say briefly, the Gnostics worked by a method, and they left us a method. And this method is still usable today. What is this method? It is the method of ecstatic cognition or ecstatic trance. Basically, I can testify to you that what I practice today in shamanism is the same technique of the Gnostics. If you want to know, if you really want to know, that is to say, to become a Gnostic, how the earth originated, how the human species itself was created, how the genome was designed, if you want to know exactly who are these archonic extraterrestrial parasites, where how they originated, where they exist, how they operate against humanity. If you want to know all that, there's only one way that you can actually know it directly, and that is by entering an ecstatic trance and knowing it in a state of ecstasy. I want to point out to everyone that what the Gnostics knew was not merely intellectual knowledge, and it was certainly not, although they were pagan intellectuals of a high order, and it was certainly not speculation or belief or dogma. It was the kind of knowledge that you can only know when you're in ecstasy.
Now,
you have to be in ecstasy to know these things.
This ecstatic trance, how was it achieved? Are there a variety of means? Were drugs employed? Did they do any kinds of dances? Was it sexual? Tantra? What kinds of things were involved to get to this state of mind?
Primarily, there were three methods of reaching the level of ecstasy where you can know things as the gods know them, on the level of a divine intelligence. But it is empirical and direct. It is not speculation. There are three methods. One was dance, sacred dance and movement. The second was through sacred sexuality, yes, because in sex, your senses and your intelligence can be heightened and honed to an extraordinary degree. But the third method, which I consider to be the most common method, widespread method, was by the use of not drugs, nope, of psychoactive plants.
Ah, good distinction. Thank you.
Right. Psychoactive plants, such as psilocybin mushrooms particularly, which did grow in Europe and were used at Eleusis, for instance. The mysteries of Eleusis have been the most widely studied of all the ancient Gnostic traditions. And it has been shown by numerous scholars, from Wasson down to Karl Ruck and many others, that the potion, the kikion, that they drank in the mysteries of Eleusis had the properties of LSD, and that it was made by an extraction of water from fermented barley. Because fermented barley has on it a certain fungus which produces the natural chemistry of LSD. And so they used psychoactive plants, as I do today, and it's not illegal in some parts of the world, I should say, to enter into ecstasy. I have to emphasize again, if you want to meet the wisdom goddess, if you want to know the origin of this planet, you can, of course, listen to the reports and findings of Gnostics such as myself, but that's secondhand information.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to know yourself, yeah, go into ecstasy. You cannot know it without being in ecstatic trance.
It is amazing how there are plants and fungi out there that... And even animals, certain toads, that if you are to consume them or somehow alter your biochemistry using them, that you're able to get to these different states of being, states of mind, and that these experiences are shared by many of the different people using them. So it's not necessarily that somebody is moving completely away from reality. It's just that they're seeing it from a shifted perspective, perhaps a broader perspective.
Exactly. Now, I'd like to counter very quickly two possible objections before we move on to the third part of the Gnostic message concerning the Archons. The two objections whenever psychoactive plants are brought up is, well, why do we need them? Why can't we just do it out of our own conscious potential? The second objection is, well, there is so many diverse reports and there are so many people just take these plants and they just hallucinate and they just use them for recreational purposes. And so how can you claim that they could be a reliable source of knowledge? Okay? Well, I'll counter both of those objections in this way. When you know what the Gnostics did, when you respect, and I ask you to bring some respect to this matter, when you respect that they had a reliable and verifiable method, then you may consider that using that method would lead to the right use of psychoactive plants. The right use, the correct use. They can be used in incorrect ways. The incorrect usage of them has led to much confusion. What is the correct way to use them, and why do we need them? The correct way to use them is to stand in the presence of nature, in a wild part of nature, not in the city, not in an apartment, to stand in the presence of nature in some place of natural beauty with your eyes open, to not hallucinate, and to have an encounter and even have a dialogue with the organic light. This is the telestic method. I outline it in great detail, and anyone who investigates it can do so.
Now,
secondly, you won't go wrong if you do that.
But real briefly, can certain people get to those states without the drugs? Without the drugs, without the psychedelic plants.
Certainly, and I have as well. And in my sort of memoir that I've written on metahistory.org called Severed Rose, I explained that I encountered the organic light initially without the use of psychoactive plants, and many other people have as well. The problem is that when that encounter occurs spontaneously with the goddess herself presenting her luminous body to a witness, the witness does not always know what it is. It has been wrongly interpreted. It may be viewed as an apparition of the Virgin Mary. It may even be seen in the form of a luminous figure of Christ, like the etheric Christ. People, in fact, don't know what they're seeing. So although those encounters definitely have occurred, and in my case as well, I have encountered the organic light both with and without psychoactive substances. The substances are provided to us by the goddess herself as tools to consistently and deliberately reach her. That is the key.
And let's say, just with going back to some of the symbolism of the various deities that could represent this goddess, you know, Columbia or Lady Liberty with the torch, perhaps even Nike. Now, it seems that the message is quite clear that this goddess brings light. Is that a correct way to interpret this? And then, if it is, do you think that the Masons who gifted the Statue of Liberty to the United States might not have been part of a plot to enslave the world, like we're so often told? But of course, today it seems like the Masons are definitely in lockstep with that plot. Were some of these groups actually trying to bring this information, keep it preserved, and eventually release it to the public, or were they maybe just keeping it for their own nefarious ends?
You know, there's a line from a Bob Dylan song. I think it's Positively 4th Street. It sort of goes like this. I wouldn't engage in a conversation with somebody who didn't know what they were talking about to begin with. You know, it's not a very good paraphrase, but the Masons, the Freemasons, these Luciferic organizations, these people who have introduced the Luciferic symbolism into society, the Statue of Liberty, they did not have the direct encounter with the organic light. They did not have it for themselves and were withholding it from humanity at large, nor did they have it to offer. I can guarantee you that with total confidence. And do you know why I can say it with confidence?
No, why?
Because as someone who has witnessed the light many times and done it with other people, I can tell you that it does not affect you in that way. The overwhelming mark that you have genuinely encountered the organic light, that you stand in the presence of the true Lucifer, of the Aeon Sophia, is that you feel overwhelmed with gratitude and generosity. And those emotions, not love, love comes too, but the prevailing emotions, and I recently had a brilliant confirmation of this, in a shamanic session with an apprentice. The overwhelming sensation of being in her presence is gratitude and generosity, and you cannot then turn around and try to use that against humanity, only keep it for yourself, or work it up into some program of mind control and manipulation, as these organizations have done. They have never encountered the goddess. They have never seen the light.
They turn the light into material, into a statue. They
turn it into a false representation that they put before humanity. They know that humanity hungers for the light.
Mm-hmm.
We are the progeny of the divine Sophia. She is our mother. I call her Pam, the planetary animal mother. Pam is our mother. We long for our mother. We long to be in her presence. We long to bathe in the undulant currents, which are materially like nougat. They're material currents of this light. I've described its properties in great detail. And they feed that hunger with their false substitutions of symbols of control and manipulation, and they must be overcome.
Yes.
The only way they can be overcome, however, is by the genuine witnesses of the light.
I'm just thinking about how much people are yearning after this light, how they turn on the TVs every day after they get home to bathe in this artificial light offered up by our controllers, by our enslavers, when they could be experiencing the real organic light of this world. Not looking for it in a book. Not looking for that the light of the world in the logos.
But actually
experiencing it. Now, of course, who doesn't want us to be in touch with this light? It brings
that's
us
right.
to part does? Three, doesn't it? We're on to hour
yes,
two.
It does.
So I think getting to the Archons, something that a lot of people have been talking about, would be a good idea. And John, you are the person who brought Archons to the forefront. And I want to commend you for that. But it seems that Archons are sometimes misconstrued, misunderstood. And with all these people out there talking about Archons now, I thought it'd be good to have you set the record straight.
I'd be happy to do that. Most happy. And I think we're moving along here pretty well, because we have got to the third part of the Gnostic message in the second hour. And that is what I call the Gnostic warning. Now, the Gnostic warning is very, very explicit, and it states that there was, at a point in human history, which if you want to put a date on it, you could date until about, let's say, 1800 BC, which is traditionally the date of the patriarch Abraham, okay? The Gnostics gave a warning about the Archons, and it went like this. It had two aspects. They said, first of all, that the Archons are an extraterrestrial species that exists exterior to the Earth, but in the solar system. So their cosmology, which is contained in the narrative of Sophia, says that the Archons existed before the Earth appeared, before Sophia turned into the Earth, and before humanity emerged on the Earth. And they actually formed the solar system as their habitat. And then the Earth emerged within the solar system. Gnostic cosmology says that the planet Earth, which is alive and includes the moon and the sun as part of its dynamic, is not part of the other planets of the system. It is captured in an inorganic system. So you have a cosmological perspective of the Archons. They are the extraterrestrials who inhabit that part of our solar system which is not organically alive in the way that the sun, moon, and earth are organically alive. Do you get that picture?
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, in addition, that these Archons prey upon humanity. And they do so in various ways. My problem, Kyle, with the Archon talk that is going on today on the internet is that while people have adopted that term
from me, which I introduced, they do not follow the Gnostic view of the Archons. And that is unfortunate, because the result is that they get into a lot of speculation. And I think it leads away from an understanding of how these Archons are actually preying upon us.
Now, could you describe the Archons a bit? Extraterrestrial, outside of this planet, parasites. People might think of the gray aliens or the reptilians. Are these actual physical entities? Are they humanoid? Are they is it just energetic? How do they represent themselves to people on the Earth as well, if they might somehow come in contact with them?
Okay, I'll give you, to the best of my ability, a profile of the Archons, which is not observed by such people as Jay Widener and others who use the term. But this is the profile based rigorously on Gnostic materials. The existing materials use two names. They use the name Drakon, which can be translated as a reptilian. And they use another name, which is Huhai, Houhai, a very strange Coptic word that means abortion or aborted fetus, but you should read as prematurely born fetus. So the existing Gnostic documents in Coptic identify two types of Archons, a Drakon or reptilian type, which they designate as kind of the overlord. Then they say that the Archons have a hive-like mentality. They are like cyborg drones, and that the large majority of them are of the Huhai, or the prematurely born fetus. Well, I interpret that as the alien gray, because the alien gray, with its big head, its big eyes, and its spindly body, resembles a prematurely born fetus, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so both those descriptions are contained in the Gnostic materials. Now you ask the question, are they physical or are they energetic? Well, they are, not only are they physical, they are energetic, and they are also psychic or infra-psychic. They have the ability to penetrate into the human psyche. This is what makes them. They are extremely dangerous predators. Now, as far as their physical existence is concerned, I'm pretty clear that the Gnostics meant to tell us that these Archons inhabit the inorganic planets of the solar system. They are, in fact, like the engineers and technicians of the inorganic planets. I would presume, and this is my extrapolation, that their primary habitat is Saturn, with its hexagonal structure and with the rings of Saturn, that they live and move around, yes, in some kind of spacecraft, in the outer dimensions of the solar system. They are not from some civilization in this galaxy or another galaxy. They are not advanced ETs from some star civilization. They arose with the solar system. This is a fact. This is an element in the Gnostic narrative. Now, they say, the Gnostics said, that because the Archons are inorganic, they cannot live in the atmosphere of the Earth, which is designed to support organic life primarily. And so they hover around the Earth, and they attempt to penetrate into the Earth in two ways, in a number of ways. One way that they do it, and this is from a direct quote from a Gnostic text, they abduct souls by night. That is to say that they can make forays into the atmosphere of the Earth, rather like deep sea divers can make forays into the depths of the sea. But they cannot stay in the atmosphere of the Earth very long. That's why they cannot invade the Earth. Oxygen is toxic to their systems in the concentration that it exists on this planet. If they were to invade the planet, they would have to convert a large part of the atmosphere of the planet, the breathable atmosphere, to formaldehyde.
Hmm. Well, John, I'm thinking about just penetrating into the Earth. What it seems that the satellites are already up there, going all around the planet, penetrating into the Earth with various frequencies and all sorts of stupid media. It's perhaps representative of their control at a very basic level.
Absolutely. That is exactly what they do. As energetic beings, as physical beings, they cannot attack the Earth because they cannot survive in the atmosphere which is designed to support animal life. But as energetic beings, they can attack the Earth viciously, and they have done so for centuries. They do this primarily through entering our minds by a kind of remote viewing technique. And by using technologies, they inspire human beings to create the very technologies by which they, the Archons, can take us over. We're actually in their service in a lot of the technology that we have invented, especially AI and IT. It's purely archontic. We don't need it to survive on this planet. It is a terrible pollutant. It is a terrible instrument of mind control. And it is a result of human beings being captured by the mindset of the Archons. They have an ability to give us their mind. And one of the first people who warned us about that is you-know-who, Carlos Castaneda.
Now, people say Carlos Castaneda just completely fabricated his different experiences. And I'd have to say, you know, some of them might have been fictional, but what he was talking about there obviously resonated with a whole lot of people and could be verified by a number of people. Now, you talk about this term of Nahual. Could you touch upon what this means? It's something that Carlos Castaneda had written about quite a bit, and people hear it if they tune into your podcasts.
Okay, there are two definitions of the Nahual. One of them, give it a capital letter. The Nahual, capitalized, means the supernatural. It means the unknown, but not the unknowable, as Castaneda pointed out. When you go into an ecstatic trance, when you go into heightened awareness, you penetrate not into another dimension, somewhere in outer space or some non-material realm, but you penetrate into the depths of the material realm of nature itself. What is at the depth? In the depths of nature, supernature. The supernatural is not beyond nature, it's within it. That is the Nahual. It is the dimension of the supernatural. Now, the second meaning is equally important. A Nahual, small letter, is a shaman. A Nahual is someone who can navigate in the supernatural, is someone who can guide others into the realm of the supernatural, and to the encounter with the organic light. A Nahual is a Gnostic shaman who can detect the Archons and repel them, as I have done many, many times. It is someone who can encounter the flyers, as Castaneda calls them, and can see how the flyers operate on us parasitically through their capacity to give us their mindset. He called it a foreign installation. I say that the Gnostics warned of this foreign installation many centuries ago. They said that Judaism, Christianity, and by extension Islam, are an alien or foreign installation in the human mind.
Okay, so could you explain how this Yahweh or the Demiurge or Yaldabaoth? Mm-hmm. Something close to that. Yes.
How Yaldabaoth.
The head Archon was able to specifically, I guess, choose a tribe of people and have them become his complete willing servants on Earth. This seems to be something that then also spread out so that these representatives on Earth then got more people to get involved in this mindset. And there are kind of different levels to this this pyramid scheme.
That's right.
As it seems to be. Now,
okay, let me give you the quote. Let me give you the quote so that people will know that this comes from a text. It doesn't come from the surviving Gnostic materials. It comes from what I called the dossier of the prosecution, okay? That is to say, the Christian ideologues who were fighting the Gnostics and eventually destroyed them and destroyed their libraries. This is from Irenaeus Against Heresies, Book 1, Chapter 30. Quote, Ieldabaoth, that's the Gnostic name for Yahweh or Jehovah, himself chose a certain man named Abraham from among the nations and made a covenant with him to the effect that if his seed continued to serve Ieldabaoth, the Archons would give to them the earth for an inheritance. Afterwards, by means of Moses, Ieldabaoth brought forth Abraham's descendants from Egypt and gave them the law, that would be the Torah, and made them Jews. End quote. I call that one single sentence the Gnostic warning about the Jews.
And now, this Abraham, he was tested, I guess, to see if he and his line would be the right stock for this this chosen tribe. And what was his test? Whether or not he'd be willing to kill his own son for this extraterrestrial deity. And he said, yeah, sure, I'll do it for whatever will be offered to me in return. If I'm subservient to this God, he will give me things. And what we're seeing unfold right now is this promise that was made, you know, the promised land.
That's right.
This actually gets really deep into the spying technologies of Israel and promise software. They have something called promise software, which was installed in all sorts of different financial and government institutions around the world, which allowed Israel to spy on basically everyone. And of course, they have their Samson option, where they say they'll destroy much of the world with nuclear weapons, which they aren't even supposed to have, if the world lets Israel fall. So this chosen people, with their idea of a promise, a covenant with God, is leading our world towards potential extinction. If this is not stopped, the world, the earth, and life upon it seem to be in complete peril.
Seem to be in peril. The point I would make at this point in our interview to really nail it down for listeners is that if you summarize the Gnostic message in an historical perspective, put it into the hard framework of history as far as we can reconstruct history, which is not always reliable, but if you do so, this is the conclusion that you get. About 1800 BC, the archonic parasites inhabiting the zones of the solar system outside the Earth achieved a major penetration into the human mind. Now, they could have made that penetration among some Chinese tribe, among some South American tribe, among some remote tribe in the depths of Africa. But it so happens that they made that penetration in a particular tribe of Semitic peoples in the Middle East. And they achieved what I call the archontic infection of the human mind, which was not only an ideological infection, the alien mindset, but was also a neurological infection, as I pointed out in August in my Red Ice interview. So there is an archontic infection, a neural hack into the human species. Now, in the historical perspective, plain and simple, what we are looking at today with the madness of Zionism, the madness of surveillance, the madness and lie of the Holocaust, the war on terror, all the insanity today on this planet, of course, has various aspects. But the core of the insanity goes back to that intrusion into the human mind, the archontic infection into the ancient Hebrews 1800 years ago. And because that infection was not checked, and because it has incubated for long periods of time and then rebooted itself as an infection will do, it has gotten more and more virulent through the centuries, as infections do when they reboot and they reboot and they become more and more powerful to resist anything against them. That's what we're facing today. The archontic infection is pandemic on this planet, and it does threaten the life of not the planet itself, excuse me, but it does threaten the life of humans on this planet, and it does threaten the possibility to have a sane society of coexistence on this planet.
Yes, I do think so. Now, John, we've been going for an hour and 20 minutes here. I think we've covered a lot of ground, but we still have a lot to get to. We should be talking about white genocide in a little bit. We'll be talking perhaps more about Jewish influence and why they are pushing white genocide, how it relates to the Archons, and anything you'd like to cover concerning the Calico War Party and the correction that has been taking place on this planet and what we might be in store for in coming months and years. But perhaps we can take a little musical break and come back in about 3 minutes. Sound good?
Fine.
Okay,
great. I'll be
here. Talk to you in just a few minutes. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, and tonight I have John Lash on the show with me. John, we were talking about the Archons before the show, and this is a very important subject, and one of their big plans, or maybe the big plan on the Earth right now, and for quite some time, has been white genocide. And when you brought this subject up on Red Ice Creations. I know it caused quite a stir. Could you please tell us about the reaction to that show and also why you felt it was such an important topic to bring up at the time?
Well, certainly. You know, I think my position on white genocide that I declared in that August talk with Red Ice shocked a lot of people for various reasons. One reason mainly was because I'm recognized as a kind of, you know, quote, spiritual teacher. I don't like this word. I prefer to call myself a visionary teacher, a teacher of the correct use of imagination, of the correct use of intelligence, and of course, a modern-day Gnostic. But that's my reputation. That's my profile. And so people were found it shocking that I would take a political stance on such a controversial issue. Also, they found it shocking that I would risk my reputation as a scholar by appearing to take what might be a pro-Aryan, pro-Nazi, and even pro-Hitler stance. And my response to that, if you haven't heard it already, goes like this. Well, if I'm taking a pro-Hitler stance in any respect, and it happens to be a pro-truth stance, then I'm willing to risk my reputation for the truth, even if it's the truth about Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. So I took that position, I hold that position, and I'd like to tell you in just 3 minutes how I came to the understanding of the importance of white genocide from a Gnostic perspective. Okay?
Sounds good.
There are two things that you need to know, that everyone needs to know about the Gnostic message. And if you don't register this and get it on board right now as you're listening to me and keep it in the forefront of your mind, then don't even bother go investigate Gnosticism. Don't even get involved. Because if you can't keep the primary features of the Gnostic message in your mind, you will not be able to benefit from that message. There are two things that everyone investigating archons has to know about the Gnostic view. The first is that the Gnostic narrative of the Sophia says that Sophia herself, our cosmic mother from the galactic core, produced the archons. She produced them by an accident, or what is called in the Gnostic writings in Greek, anomou, A-N-A-M-O-U, an anomaly. Now, anybody, I advise you, anybody who talks about the archons, whether it be Laura Eisenhower or Jay Widener or anyone else, and who does not cite the Gnostic material telling you that the planetary goddess herself produced them, is not to be trusted, period. Okay? Mm-hmm. Second point. The thing that you need to know if you want to get involved with Gnosticism and investigate it through my book and my site is that the myth of the Aeon Sophia, the fallen goddess scenario, is unique in two ways. One I've already explained. It is the single, coherent, and comprehensive plot of Earth evolution and the origin of humanity ever produced by the human mind. That is a fact. The second thing you need to know about it is that it is an unfinished myth. It is a myth of participation. It is a myth that you become involved in and whose outcome is decided by your involvement. Do you understand that? It's mm-hmm. It's technically what mythologists call a participatory myth. Now, the Gnostics left us a clue that at some point in the future, relative to their time, 2,000 years ago, an event would occur on this planet called the deorthosis of Sophia. And that word deorthosis may be translated as correction. This subject of the correction of the Sophia is to me the most important subject on this planet from anyone who cares about the future of the planet.
And I'm not afraid to take a monopolistic or megalomaniac stance on that. I consider that to be of paramount importance.
Well, I think everybody wants the correction. They might not know the term, but everybody is looking for this and wanting to be a part of it.
We want to make right the lies. We want to overturn the lie. We want to make right what is wrong on this planet. And that and the mythological cue for doing that is called Sophia's Correction, about which I have spoken extensively. It was my understanding of Sophia's Correction, which began in March of 2014. I plotted the whole reset for Sophia's Correction in the Gaian Navigation Experiment. The point of that correction, the focus of that correction, brought me to white genocide. And that is why in August of 2014, just a few months into her correction, I decided to come forth and take a stance on that subject.
Now, why is it that you think these archons are putting together this plan? Why are white people so hated by this god? It seems to me that perhaps this god is either jealous or is upset that he can't fully control white people. Perhaps they present some kind of an obstacle. Is there any hints in the Gnostic texts as to why white genocide might be taking place?
Not really any direct or literal hints, Kyle. This is the point where we have to take responsibility for our participation in the myth. And we have to take up the baton, as it will, and take up the banner and the Gnostic message and carry forth the completion of the myth, carry forth correction on the terms that we define. This is the challenge. Gnosticism left us with a huge challenge. Now, I would explain to you, to the best of my ability, why, in that perspective, I would explain why white genocide is so imperative, not only for the archons, but for the proxies and agents of the archons, which are primarily the Jews. They are in the executive position, but they are not the only ones, because there are also non-Jews and Jew wannabes who serve the same evil program. Of every race and ethnicity, including the Chinese. Look at Chinese communism under Maoism. Under Mao, what was that? They were Chinese, but they were carrying out the Jewish program of Marxism, weren't they?
Well, I think that the Asians and actually the white people have been some of the biggest people, the biggest forces to pick up this load that the Archons has put on us and carry it forward and do it with zeal, because we've been deluded. It seems that the white people on this planet have been harnessed, you know, pretty much by the slave driving Jews to fulfill the vision of the Archons. So I'm just wondering why, when it seems white people are pretty much controlled, enslaved, that they would want to get rid of them at this point. It seems...
Right. That's a very good question. A very, very good question. We're looking at a paradox. This is a staggering challenge to look at. By the way, I want to say again that if you investigate Gnosticism, and I advise that you do so through the direction that I've provided on my site, because otherwise you'll get entirely lost in the disinformation about the subject. You've got a big, big responsibility on your hands to sort this out. How can it be that so many white people have been enlisted into this cause, and yet at the same time, whites are the most serious threat to the Jews and to the defeat of this cause? This is a really big question to face. And so let's see if in the 25 minutes we have left, we can come up with some palpable response to this question, okay?
Okay, and definitely let's consider some of the solutions too, because I would like to talk about the Calico War Party.
Sure.
And what people themselves can do at many different levels in order to fight our enslavement, release ourselves from the enslavers, and really take control of our gift. You know, this planet is such a gift. It's such an amazing place that we could call our home, and yet we're kept from it. We're kept from our real inheritance. So
that's right. We are kept from our real inheritance. The Gnostic message, particularly the narrative of the Aeon Sophia, the fallen goddess Sonaro, is the birthright of the entire human race. I am certain that by reclaiming this birthright and uniting ourselves in this narrative, there is the opportunity to turn this entire game around. Now, let me just talk about white genocide for a moment from the perspective that I understand it.
Okay.
To begin, I want to make a statement that I would like to broadcast loud and clear into the minds of everyone who ever listens to this interview. It has four words, and they go like this. Evil has no color. Okay? So first of all, to attribute the great preponderance of evil on this planet to the white race, as some people are currently doing, is entirely false. It's a huge lie, and it's a huge deception. There is, no matter how you look at race and no matter how do you study racial tendencies, there is no evidence whatsoever that the capacity to do evil to others or to become involved in agendas of social evil depends upon race or color. Every single color on this planet, with the notable exception of the Reds, that would be the American Indians, has perpetrated evil against humanity. The Chinese have, white people have in their own way, black people have perpetrated evil against other black people, and they do so massively in the United States today, as you know. We're not told about that. And so when it comes to the subject of evil and working against humanity, evil has no color.
Well, it seems the American Indians, well, they warred with each other and also with other races in the history of the Americas. So,
but they did not have a massive agenda of, they did not get involved in massive agendas of destruction, as far as I know.
Yeah, some of that history might be suppressed, because when you look at the Salutrian hypothesis, which has a whole lot of evidence about whites in America, and actually white tribes did exist even when America was recolonized following Columbus. So there have been whites in America, but it seems that they actually existed on a much larger scale, and whether or not they were genocided by the who we call now the American Indians is up for debate, but there are stories about the different instances of those American Indian tribes killing the red-headed giants in one example.
Well, that's excellent. That's excellent, and I'm glad you brought that up, Kyle, and I would stand corrected on that as time goes by. But let's just say that for the moment we face this riddle. How can some whites have been involved in activities which are in the service of the Jews and the Archons, as today the Imperial Military Force of the USSA, the United Soviet States of America, being the main weapon of military might for the Jews, right? How can this be? And at the same time, how can whites be a threat to the program of the Archons and their Jewish proxies? Well, this is the big question that we face. And the answer, I think, is coming into focus. I can't say that I have the precise answer right now, but I can suggest the direction in which to look.
Okay.
Well, Germany.
Yeah.
Germany and Adolf Hitler and the pagan Teutonic peoples. I don't think that it would benefit us, honestly, to go way, way back into the centuries of development of the archontic mindset. Let's not do that. I think the answer to the threat that whites play, that whites pose to the Jewish archontic agenda is very recent. As I understand the facts of history, which have been kept from us, distorted and suppressed, Adolf Hitler was a champion for the revival of the German nation. You know, I try to say, the National Socialist Workers' Party. I try to say the National Socialists. I don't say the word Nazi because Nazi is anti-white hate speech.
Yes, it is.
Pure and simple.
It's not really what they called themselves. There's very little evidence that they actually referred to themselves as Nazis. That they were disparagingly called that by the outsiders. And
that's
of
right.
course they needed to completely tell all sorts of lies about Adolf Hitler and the German state, because they were doing something completely unprecedented. They were unleashing the creativity of their people, and they turned around a completely failed economy, a depressed people, in no time flat. You had America, which was
three years. 6 million jobs. Not 6 million Jews gassed, but 6 million jobs created in 3 years. Right.
Yeah, so it showed a blueprint for others to follow. You know, if you were to completely take out the whole alleged Holocaust, then people and the fake Holocaust, they suffered a bit under Germany, but the white race suffered incredible amounts from that war. But we're not even allowed to talk about that. But if you took out the Holocaust from the equation, then people would be saying, why the hell did we fight these guys? Well, hell, in 1938, Time magazine had Adolf Hitler as Man of the Year. He's doing incredible things. The Germans are well ahead of everybody else in technology. They invented television and broadcast the 1936 Olympics. When did America get television? The V2 rocket. Right. They could have gone up into space. But, of course, the Americans took that and appropriated the V2, along with so many other things, just stole all of the inventiveness of the Germans and took it for their own, perverted it, and didn't let the common people, the Volk, have any part of it. And so it's we have a complete misunderstanding, for the most part, of that era, because just like with the great religious inquisitions, just burning and hoarding all of these texts about what they really were about, what they were doing, and presenting us with a completely false view of what the Germans were about in the Third Reich, or what the pagans were like in Europe.
Well, they were pagans. What you see in Hitler and in the Germanic movement, the Germanic nationalist movement after World War I, was an attempt, twofold attempt. First of all, the attempt of the German people to recapture and recreate their nation, which has been destroyed by the evil doings of Jewish bankers and their accomplices. And secondly, the attempt, which is widely seen among the Germans, to go back to their pagan roots and to re-identify themselves and rebrand themselves in that manner. Unfortunately, the element of Christianity was strongly prevalent in the Nazi Party. If you ever read The Holy Reich, it's a book that you need to read about the Christianity of the Third Reich. It's unfortunate that they couldn't purge themselves of that. But that's another story. The point
they had to fight too many other battles first, I think.
They had so many battles, that's right. Yeah. The point I want to make is that we're not going to spend the precious 15 minutes we have left talking about all the facts that have been kept from us.
Right.
For instance, the fact that the leading Jewish historian, Raoul Hilberg not only said, one, that there is no single autopsy proving that any Jew was ever gassed. Two, he also said that the figure of the Jews who died in the war could be revised down to about 600,000. And three, Raoul Hilberg, this is the leading Jewish historian of the Holocaust, also said that although there is no documentary proof or any proof in Hitler's recorded speeches or records that there was a final solution in effect, he believes that there was and that it was coordinated among the Nazi leaders by telepathy. That's why there's no written proof of it, because they were telepathically communicating with each other to implement the final solution of the Jews. Yeah, okay,
They were giving nudges and winks.
These are facts.
Basically. Yeah.
Not to mention the fact that Raoul Hilberg himself, Hilberg, said that the number of Jews who died in the war could be arguably reduced to about 600,000. Measure that against the 1.2 million Germans, twice as much, German soldiers who died in the camps under Eisenhower in the first 6 months after the war. We're not being told these things, but they're out there now. They're out there now. Yeah, so the facts are coming through.
The Holocaust has been used to hide all of the different crimes which are being detailed in the Hellstorm documentary, and which, of course, came from Hellstorm, the book by Thomas Goodrich. But it's all well documented what happened to the German people. They'll try to downplay it, but they have to have this Holocaust to justify it or to sweep it underneath the rug.
What you have really when you do, and it doesn't take a lot of research, does it, Kyle? I would say the serious person could spend maybe a month giving, say, 20 hours a week to research to see that what you have is the facts of Hitler, the facts of the war, and the facts about the lie of the Holocaust measured against the Hollywood version of the Holocaust, period. And we don't, you know, we know that now, but to get around to the, to cut to the chase here, I would say that the reason why the white genocide meme is going around, and the reason why the white genocide program is now in effect is because in Sophia's correction, and with the internet since 9/11 bringing the facts to public attention, there is a huge, huge risk that the Holocaust lie will be overturned. If the Holocaust lie is overturned in the immediate future, then it will become evident that Adolf Hitler was not a mad tyrant out to conquer the world. He had one mission and one goal, and that was to protect Germany and Europe against Jewish Bolshevik communism, period. Yes. Therefore, he stands as the most recent historical example of white Aryan people resisting the Jewish archontic agenda. That is why the focus is now on white genocide, because they cannot allow that to be known, nor they can allow the recapturing of that power to be turned against them.
Yes.
That's
I
why
think
it's happening.
They see the potential of the internet as well.
They do.
White people were enslaved into their agenda for quite some time, unknowingly serving it. But now, recently, and I think they've always known the potential was there, white people are using their intelligence not to further ends that don't serve them whatsoever, but really to question this whole system that has been placed over us, has been used to absolutely exploit our labor and our creativity, use it against us. I think that now more than ever, people are just completely sick and fed up. And at the forefront of a lot of this exposing that is being done, if you look at the alternative media, it is largely white. Even if a lot of them aren't even pro-white, it still is white people who is honestly trying to change things for the better. If you just look at slavery in the United States,
of course,
it was overturned.
Who overturned slavery? By white people.
For moral That's reasons, right. not for economic reasons. Of course, That's everybody right. became enslaved eventually. White people, black people, pretty much all people. There Sometimes is so even much... those chosen people.
That's right. There is so much history to correct. But I am convinced from the experience of my life day to day and the people gathering around me, you might say, that Sophia's correction is indeed taking place. And the way to understand that correction, apart from the depth of the Gnostic wisdom, is to understand that it is a correction of the lies that we have been sold. And there has been a great focus on selling lies about the white race and whitey, the devil, as if white people had committed the greater part of evil on this planet. Well, that is certainly not true. And I would like to register also a final statement in people's minds. I don't deny that some white people through history have done their fair share of evil on this planet, but they have not done either more or less than people of other colors. But white people have contributed more to the excellence on this planet than any other color. And that is an irrefutable fact. And I want to add finally that as a white person, I must say that I am surprised every day that I am talking about this subject at this moment in my life, because all through my life, I never considered race to be an issue of any kind whatsoever. White people are the least racist people that I have ever known, and I put myself in that list. And I think it is absolutely perverse and sick to accuse white people of being racist on a whole, categorically speaking, because that is certainly not my experience. White
Even a
people
person
like myself, yeah.
A person like Go myself, ahead. Called a white supremacist by the media.
Yeah.
In my
yeah.
day-to-day life, even now that I'm well-known around the world for my views, you know, at least on the internet, in our circles, I'm still not going around just hating people, being mean to people. I don't always love seeing what I'm seeing out there in the world, but I don't have a great amount of ill will towards others just because they're a different color than myself, but our enemies obviously would like to paint us all. Even those out there who hate themselves for being white, they're now being saddled with white privilege, with white guilt.
Right.
It's
right.
amazing.
It is. So I just want to make that point. And since we just have 10 minutes left, I wonder if we can bring it around to the Calico War Party.
We can go a little bit over the two-hour mark, and we'll still be broadcasting out and recording. So don't worry too much about the time. But we also do have a caller on the line, so maybe we'll, if the caller would like to hold, we can get to you in just a little bit. And also, if anybody else wants to call in, please, 347-633-9657. John, please continue.
I use the term arete, which is a Greek word, A-R-E-T-E. It means excellence. And I use the term arete, and I call myself an aretist, A-R-E-T-E. IST. I'm not a supremacist. I'm an aretist. What does that mean? It means that I recognize and celebrate the excellence of all races. And what I have discovered from investigating and celebrating the excellence of all races is that if you make a simple inventory from history coming forward, say, for the last 500 years if you want to, or the last 2,000 years, or even 4,000 years, and you make a simple inventory of the excellence in technology, the arts, in literature, in poetry, in the practical development of everyday life, in medicine, in philosophy. If you make an inventory of that excellence for the Chinese race, the Negroid races, the Red American Indian races, the Russian races, whatever races you want to put on the list, the Jewish races, you will find, excuse me, that the list of achievements of excellence of the white races far excels all others. Now, you can call me a supremacist because I say that, but I'm not talking about supremacy, because that excellence achieved by the white races, for example, the Germanic races, in their technology, their music, their art, their literature, their culture, their painting, if you consider that, it is an excellence for which all of humanity has benefited. It is not an excellence that is calculated for a supremacist agenda, but it is an excellence from which everyone benefits. So I ask you this question. Were you to make that assessment, were you to take the responsibility to look at the different races and see what they have offered as excellence for the benefit of all humanity, you will find that the white races have contributed the most.
It seems that the white races played something of the Luciferian role of Prometheus,
right,
bringing fire from the gods for the benefit,
right,
of mankind. And yet in time, mankind turns on this deity, turns on this.
But that's more recent than we're led to believe. I think it's a recent tactic taken by the archontic Jewish element and their minions and accessories, who realize that they are under threat. Since the Hitler Third Reich event, were the white races ever to rise again in any kind of unity against them, the enemies of humanity, they would be wiped out and wiped off the planet. And I am committed to seeing that happen.
Well, let's talk about the Calico War Party then.
Sure.
What is this all about? Where can people find it? And what can they do?
Okay, 2 points. You can find my talk on the Calico War Party, which was given on the 26th of December, 2014, to Red Ice, widely on various YouTube channels. You can find the entire talk.
Right.
Henrik gave both parts freely. He didn't hold back the second half for members because he did it as a favor to me and he thought it was important.
Oh, it was a great discussion.
I want to make 2 points about the Calico War Party. I begin and introduce the theme and purpose of the Calico War Party by referring, get this, to one of the feats of literary excellence that is unparalleled on this planet. And that is the work called Parzival by Wolfram von Eschenbach, who was German, who was a Bavarian knight of the 13th century, actually. 1220 was about the time that he completed Parzival. I introduce the Calico War Party by the story of Parzival, which is a classical story from Aryan Germanic literature of the quest for the Holy Grail. Now, you recall that I said earlier, what is the Holy Grail? The Holy Grail is the experience of encountering directly the living luminosity of the planet Earth. The planet Earth is luminous. It is more luminous than the sun and moon. But that luminosity is hidden and must be encountered in an ecstatic state. In fact, you cannot stand before that luminosity and witness it if you are not in ecstasy, because it puts you into a state of ecstasy and heightened perception. So the story of Parzival by the great, great German poet Wolfram von Eschenbach contains the legend of the Grail, and it also contains the model or prototype of the Calico War Party.
Okay, so this is something that people can do themselves. You've talked about it on Red Ice, and there are different roles that people can fulfill. So it's not something that people need to join up and get a membership of. This is
no.
People are doing this of their own initiative, using the skills that they've already developed or developing some new ones
specifically for this, and attacking, perhaps even just by exposing elements of the system that is killing us, that is enslaving us, and which is in desperate need of overthrowing.
That's right, of direct opposition. Can we continue to talk, by the way, just as we were before?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, let me make 2 points about the Calico War Party. The first is that it is a volunteer organization and that people will self-organize within the party. It has no central control. It is totally unilateral. It is totally non-hierarchical. Let me tell you what I
consider personally to be the genius of the Calico War Party,
if you will. The current situation today is that the archontic infection on this planet has gone so far unchecked that human animals who simply want to live and get along, people of goodwill who can coexist and just want to thrive and get along by mutual aid, are confronted by dozens of attacks on all levels of life. We are being attacked in all ways. And the problem is that no one single person can handle all these battles and can operate on all these fronts. So when I came up with the blueprint of the Calico War Party, what I had in my mind was the imperative necessity to pick your battles. For instance, I think I would not be surprising anyone if I said today that today two horrific social evils on this planet are institutionalized pedophilia and the monopoly of the big pharmaceutical companies peddling destructive drugs to the population.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? These are just two issues. I'm not talking about chemtrails. I'm not talking about the Jewish program for mass immigration and using mass immigration in Europe and in America to destroy the population. We could sit here for the next half hour and just list the things that are being done.
Oh yeah.
In what I call social evil. So obviously, if any one person is going to do anything about these evils, rather than just complain about them, and rather than just finger point the perpetrators, if you're actually going to do something, first, you need to dedicate your entire life to it. And second, you need to focus. So the Calico War Party is a tool for focusing on that area of social evil which you personally can handle and where you personally have the passion and the dedication to make a difference. It's just a blueprint.
For example, I'm working on the Hellstorm documentary right now. It's going to be out next month. This has taken an incredible amount of focus, but and it's in one particular area of research, but it's something that I was in a position to be able to do, and I thought it was important to do. So I'm dedicating my efforts to penetrating through our enemy's defenses here. And I think it's a vulnerability, a big one. So that's what I decided to take on. Other people
right.
out there can take on whatever their interest might be, their speciality, wherever you can be most effective.
Well, that's right. Wherever you can be most effective. And another key to that concerns the area of events in the world today. Interestingly enough, I'm looking up Calico War Party here because I'm going to tell you what party you're in, okay, what band you're in. The area of life today where your hatred is focused. I talk a lot about hatred. I started to talk about hatred during the Gaia navigation experiment, and I used a stunning excerpt from a talk by Rajneesh in which he compares the power of love and the power of hatred. In that talk, Rajneesh points out that hatred can be pure, and that hatred can be something that is sacred and something that is necessary for life. I personally feel that if you do not have the hatred for that which can destroy your life and destroy what you love, then you are not capable of protecting what you love. We need hatred to protect what we love. We cannot protect what we love with love. We can only protect it with hatred. So I've talked a lot about the positive value of hatred. And so I suggest in the CalicoWarParty.org website that you consider that which you hate the most. Now I'll take you as an example, if I may, Kyle. Obviously, you hate the historical lie of the Holocaust. Obviously, you hate the slander and distortion around the National Socialist Movement and what it really was, and around Adolf Hitler. Obviously, you hate the suppression of the truth about what was done to the Germanic people, the German nation, not only from the Treaty of Versailles at the end of World War I, but all the way through, even up to today, the Germans are paying reparation for things that they never did, that their ancestors never did. Because you focus through your hate on that field, you can then be most effective where you are focusing. And that places you in a band of the Calico War Party, which I would say is called a band, which band is it? I think it's band 11. The dedication of the warriors in band 11 is to correct the historical narrative. Now, obviously, if you're putting your life into that, and you have to put your life into it, then you can't go and work on exposing institutionalized pedophilia. You can't go out into the fields and be tearing up GMO crops, can you? You can't be going to, attacking the surveillance of the NSA. You can't be doing that. It's more than any one human being can do. So the blueprint of the Calico War Party allows you to place yourself in a band and in that way to focus yourself on something you can really change.
Yeah, and I like to switch from topic to topic sometimes. As a radio host, you kind of do to keep your audience, exposed to new material. But all my extra energy, I like to focus on one particular, well, I'd say weak spot, and also something I care about. This really is, it means a lot to me. It means a lot to many people in the world, and it is such a crucial element of our history. But as you mentioned with pedophilia, this is something I was talking about years ago online before, Corey Feldman came out and did his interview talking about what was going on in Hollywood. Right. Before all of these people in the British government, the American government were exposed, it's so great to see that this information is really getting out there and doing damage. People are using weapons against our enemies to take them down. The amount that they have fallen from grace is quite incredible in the past few years with all of the information that has been going out on the internet. And people are laughing at them. That's very dangerous for them.
It's very dangerous. That's right.
When they're becoming jokes.
And that's they are. And it's not just exposing people. It's actually taking them down.
Yes.
That's the object of the Calico War Party. If you go to the calicowarparty.org, which contains the manifesto and the blueprint of the party, the protocols, and so forth, it says, this site presents the morality and method for eliminating psychopaths and enemies of life from the world. This is a proactive program to take them down. But what everyone has to understand is, if you're going to make a difference against this force of social evil, which is vast and many faceted, you can only make a difference by giving your entire life to it. And you can only give your entire life to one particular thing, as you have to focus on one particular thing. But the beauty of the blueprint of the party, the Thunderbird Formation, is that even if you and I, for instance, I'm not focusing on the pedophilia issue. I support people who are pursuing it, and I try to keep current with it. But by looking at the blueprint of the party, I know that there are people focusing on that battle while I'm focusing on my battle. So there is a unity in the party that is unparalleled, I believe, until now. And this is the moment for the party to strike.
Yes. Now, you talk about striking from not only a physical level, which could involve, say, going out with just signs, going out and making a mockery of our enemy's propaganda, whatever in those instances. And it doesn't just include physical strikes. Somehow, taking out somebody who's in a position of control. It also
includes, this is dangerous talk here.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm trying to get past here. What I'm trying to get at is the magical strike you've mentioned.
That's
in
right.
your talks. What is this? Because this is something that a lot of people who don't want to go out and just, let's say, beat up a world controller or can't get to them to do so.
No, we can't get to them.
Right. Yeah. They could potentially, if they have the proclivity and time and passion, attack them on something of a metaphysical or magical level. Could you please describe that?
Okay. Now we're getting really into the heat of the battle here. What I'm proposing in the Calico War Party, in the Thunderbird formation, so what you have to look at is the Thunderbird formation. When you place yourself, and this is a volunteer thing, I don't tell anybody where they are in the bands of the party. There are 17 bands. You tell yourself where you are. It's a volunteer Delta Force type strike force. Now, there are many ways in which the strike force can operate. For instance, there is a band. It's one of the front bands. It's called the Kurukula Band, number 13. And this band has particular assignments. Each band has its assignments. For instance, the KWP site says that Band 13 is assigned to breaking all taboos and to using guerrilla warfare, particularly on glamour and advertising, breaking through repressive cultural norms, attacking conformity and censorship, and using pranks, ridicule, and street-side guerrilla tactics, including satire, to discredit the cultural authorities and to destroy and counter cultural Marxism. Now, this is a very vast assignment, but it is a very particular assignment. So, for instance, if you place yourself in the Band 13, what kind of activities would you be disposed to pursue? Well, one thing would be to go out and physically attack advertising. Not only to attack the signs and posters of advertising, but to do everything possible to discredit it and expose it and to actually make it not work. Like, for instance, a simple act of using black paint canisters to black out advertising posters. See what I mean? So these kind of activities, which, by the way, are not my idea, people are already doing this, okay, could be an aspect, one of the aspects of the activism of the party. Then we come to the very dicey question of eliminating the arch predators. It's my understanding that these people will not stop unless they are stopped. There is no legal means, there is no argument, there is no way to stop a psychopath on a murderous rampage except by direct lethal force. So, what is John Lash getting at here? Am I out there announcing the Calico War Party and openly encouraging people to assassinate some of the arch predators on the planet? And, you know, goddess knows, it's common knowledge who they are, you know? No, I'm not exactly doing that, because the fact of the matter is that the real arch predators who are running the agenda of social evil can't be reached. And you would be crazy to undertake a suicide or kamikaze mission, for instance, in trying to knock out somebody like, you know, George Soros, just to pick a name out of the blue. No, I would never encourage people to do anything like that. What I'm doing is presenting the alternative of taking them out by magic, by using magic.
Now, well, first off, is psychic assassination, if you want to term it that, is that even illegal? I don't think so. And who could ever really prove that you did it?
Well, hey, look, I have looked, Kyle, it's so brilliant you bring this up, because I've looked at this long and hard, believe me. I am not in a foolhardy and reckless manner talking to you today. I hope that you understand, and those who hear me understand, that I am talking in the deepest sobriety of my mind. I have considered, first of all, let's consider the fucking facts in your face. They don't need a reason to tase you, to come to your house and get you or to kill you. They do it all the time. So I'm not worried about a reason. I'm not worried about going on trial because right. I am promoting magic as a way to kill psychopathic predators. Because if they want to take me out, they don't need that reason or any other reason. Mm-hmm. What I'm proposing is that there is a real shamanic magic capable of not only psychically assassinating them, but of physically terminating them. And I would like to try it out.
All right. Can people learn more about this so they can take part? What kinds of things does this involve? Does this involve what has been termed high magic, white magic, black magic? Okay. Please explain.
This is Calica Magic. It's a new game on the planet. And if you go to the Calica War Party YouTube channel, you'll see that there is a film that demonstrates the Calica technique, which is a shamanic technique called courting. If you learn this technique of courting, then you can apply it to what is called the Calica Lethal Strike. You can actually cast a death spell. I am teaching people since January of 2015 how to cast a death spell. And the instructions of how to do that are on the Calico War Party YouTube channel.
All right. Well, I know that people out there have at least a few people in mind.
Hey, listen, is it difficult? I use the analogy when I talk to people about this in person, which, by the way, I primarily do because obviously – you know, I'm taking a risk in doing this. I like to have the people in front of me in flesh and blood. I'm taking this opportunity to talk to you because I won't use the word faith, but I have a confidence in the Renegade team, okay? And I feel solidarity with you. So I'm taking a chance here of telling you this. Well, you're welcome. You know, shamanism, there's been a shamanic revival that began in the 1960s with the psychedelic revolution and has escalated massively to this day. But unfortunately, this shamanic revival, which is promoted by such people as my colleague Graham Hancock, systematically ignores half of the shamanic calling. The shamanic calling in all indigenous societies was not only for the shaman to retrieve souls who were lost in the Nahual and to heal people, but it was also to kill. A true shaman can kill as well as heal. So I am reviving that aspect of the shamanic calling, and I am presenting people with the technology of the lethal strike that can be used in very specific conditions in Gayan Tantra to take out psychopaths and enemies of life on this planet. And that is what I introduced this year in January.
Now, does this work because we all are connected this Earth's energy system? Is that how it's transmitting?
It works primarily for two reasons. First of all, it works because it uses what I would call elucidated rage, targeted rage. Bear in mind that whether or not people can understand the things we discussed this evening, whether or not they can take in the Gnostic message of the Archons and the Jews as the proxies of the Archons and on and on and on, there is tremendous rage in the human animal against what is being done to it on this planet. Human animals are just like any other animals. If you take a gerbil, if you take a guinea pig, if you take a cat and you put it into a room and you torture it and subject it to conditions, it will get really, really pissed. The human animal is in a state of rage, but the problem is how to target and direct that rage. So the Calica technique of taking out predators uses the rage that is already there, the rage against the machine, the rage against the predators. But secondly, it does something else. It uses the power of the earth to facilitate the magic. And this is what the specific technique of courting does. Courting is a technique, simple, easy to learn, easy to practice, that utilizes the entire power of the earth in order to facilitate these magical strikes against the enemies of life. I've explained this in great detail, and I intend to continue to explain it even more in the immediate future.
John, without getting into any real detail here, have you seen the effects of the party taking place and your own particular strikes? Have they materialized? Have they taken out targets?
Not yet, but I have to say that I wouldn't expect it at this moment, because I launched the Calico War Party in stealth mode. I'm just going to leave that statement as it is without explanation. I can tell you that those of you who would investigate the party, read the manifesto in detail, read the protocols, they're very important, and look at the Thunderbird formation. And if you do so, I can tell you that you can expect, you can anticipate, that in August of this year, the party goes active. And if there is to be public evidence of successful strikes, they will proceed from August of this year. But right now, the party is in stealth mode.
And, of course, this party is an element of Sophia's correction, correct?
This is
an instrument of it. Do you see anything else that has been manifesting or that might come about in this world that would be evidence of this correction and where it might be leading?
Okay, recently in the news flashes that I do, which are talks posted on metahistory.org, I made a distinction between what I call the rectification and correction. Correction is an event now unfolding on this planet, such as the Calico War Party, which could be considered as the arrowhead of correction, that is shared and implemented by people who know Sophia's story, which is just a handful of people at this moment as I speak. But at the same time, among those who do not know her story and don't have the Gnostic intel, correction takes place as a form of rectification. So they are also involved in it, even though they do not know that they are. So I recognize both. Now you ask me the question, do I see other signs? Yeah, I see signs of rectification. That is to say, Sophia's correction unfolding among the people who don't know her story. One good example is Pegida. Pegida is the largest anti-Islamic, anti-immigration movement in Europe. And it is gaining strength by the day. And very interestingly, Kyle, Pegida was founded in Dresden.
Yes, that is very telling. That is very telling. It's basically like a European phoenix rising from the ashes there, in my opinion.
Exactly.
And people can look at the group and say, oh, the leadership or the official organization takes this stance or that, or this person's compromised. That doesn't even matter to me, because the will and the sentiment of the people involved is so organic and righteous. It's genuine.
It's genuine and it's authentic. No matter, you know, there's always a problem with leadership and organization. That's why I'm happy to say that there is no leadership of the Calico War Party. I'm not the leader of the Calico War Party. I am simply the Nahual who gives definition to the party. That's all. It shall never have a leader, because it exists of unilateral bands across the planet who self-organize. So there's always a problem with the corruption of leadership, as you know. But nonetheless, there is Pegida, and there are countless other examples. I can't keep track of them. I see them day by day here in Europe. And I must say that I see many examples of Sophia's correction becoming manifest. But I am focusing, of course, on those who are in the correction consciously, such as those in the Calico War Party.
Okay, great. Well, John, we have a caller who's been waiting on the line here for a little while. Do you mind if we go to this call and then we can wrap up the show after that?
All right, let's do.
All right, great. Hello, I think this would be Jeb. Jeb, welcome to the show. Jeb, are you there? All right, take care. Okay, so, John, it looks like we don't have any more callers, so we can just start to wrap up. Any final thoughts you had about any of the topics we've discussed tonight or something that you feel is very important and pressing that we should get to before we close out the show here?
Well, sure. There's a few things floating around in my mind. First of all, I want to say to anyone out there, if you really want to make a difference and correct what's happening on this planet, if you really want to bring life on this planet back to sanity and take us out of the banker's game of war and take us out of the lies of history, it's not enough to expose it. It's not. You have to oppose it. And you have to oppose it with the entire force of your life. You have to commit your whole life to it, because what is worth living for is worth dying for. But I would add to that provision a most wonderful qualification, is that if you involve yourself in the solution on this planet, you can do it with the planet. You can do it in collaboration with the intelligence of the planet itself. You're not alone, and Planetary Tantra is the method of doing that. Planetary Tantra is my term, my meme, my title, if you will, for the revival of Gnosticism today. Planetary Tantra is simply a power-sharing agreement with the Earth. No one single person can make a difference unless the passion and power of that individual is rooted in love for the Earth and in connection to her. And then all bets are off and everything is possible.
Well, that is that's definitely inspiring. I think that we really do need to access all of the power we can at this time and use it. Use it for creating a better future, for actually changing things instead of just falling into the false oppositions that we see put all around us. Now, when you're talking about basically people coming to this realization of the goddess Sophia and their power upon this earth and in connection to the earth, It's great, but do you think that it will eventually reach a lot of people? It might reach a critical mass, and maybe that's only tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. But do you think that this understanding will eventually someday become the widespread, wide known, maybe even universalistic religion? Do you think it will kind of be widely understood at some point, or will this only be amongst perhaps what could be termed the real elite of the planet?
Well, I've asked myself that question many times. I thought the other day that in the course of this interview, I might as well ask, minorities, right? Well, the pagan pre-Christian people of Europe and the whole world, North America, the Indians of the South America, the pagan, the heathen, pre-Christian peoples.
John,
the persecuted minority on this guy. Yeah.
Unfortunately, it sounds like your connection is just starting to cut out. Maybe that's a sign we should save this.
We should.
Yeah, maybe we'll save this for a future conversation. John, it's been great talking to you tonight. I really appreciate the conversation we've had tonight. A lot of very interesting topics. Please, I think the audience might be able to understand if you want to give any last brief thoughts where people can find your sites. Of course, gaiaspora.org, metahistory.org. The book is Not in His Image, and it's people can just search for Calica War Party. There's a lot out there on you. So any final things you'd like to point people towards?
No, that's it. I think we achieved our goal, and I'm really happy that you invited me, Kyle, and proud to have talked with you. So we'll pick it up at another time and go on from there. How about that?
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Okay.
And thank you out there to people listening all around the world. Really do appreciate your support. Check out all of the other great hosts here on the network. A lot of great things coming up and a lot of really interesting shows recently. So please do stay tuned. And I will be back next week with Dennis Fetcho. So a lot to look forward to. Take care, everyone.
There's sex in bed.